Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, the final part of The Life and Times of activist historian Howard Zinn, plus President Trump in a rousing denunciation of Howard Zinn. I hope you'll stay tuned. Now, on to the third and final part of our series, Life and Times of Howard Zinn. Most of the series is audio drawn from the 2004 documentary on Zinn, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. This final part covers three aspects of Zinn's career: the public reception, especially by schools, of Zinn's A People's History of the United States, and also Zinn's modest career as a playwright, and finally, his opposition to starting a war against Iraq in the wake of 9/11. But since this segment starts out with the people's history, we will begin with a vocal opponent. In September 2020, President Trump denounced Zinn for his pernicious effect on the patriotism of schoolchildren. We'll hear Trump's thoughts, courtesy of the September 18 edition of Democracy Now!, then a 2009 recording of Zinn explaining the effects he had hoped to produce in school children. Here is Amy Goodman.
On Thursday, President Trump lashed out at educators who teach about the U.S. history of slavery and racism, announcing a so-called patriotic education plan to combat what he called toxic propaganda in schools. Trump called the teaching of critical race theory a form of child abuse, lashed out at the 1619 Project, the Pulitzer Prize-winning series by the New York Times, which reexamines the legacy of slavery. Trump also directly criticized Howard Zinn during his speech at the National Archives Museum in Washington, D.C.
Left-wing rioting and mayhem are the direct result of decades of left-wing indoctrination in our schools. It's gone on far too long. Our children are instructed from propaganda tracts like those of Howard Zinn that try to make students ashamed of their own history.
So we're turning back now to 2009. Howard Zinn appearing on Democracy Now! Less than a year before he died. He just published Young People's History of the United States. I asked him to respond to a question he'd frequently been asked about his work. Is it right to be so critical of the government's policies of the traditional heroes of the country?
It's true that people have asked that question again and again. Now, should we tell kids that Columbus, whom they have been told was a great hero, that Columbus mutilated Indians and kidnapped them and killed them in pursuit of gold? Should we tell people that Theodore Roosevelt, who is held up as one of our great presidents, was really a warmonger who loved military exploits and who congratulated an American general who committed a massacre in the Philippines? Should we tell young people that? And I think the answer is, we should be honest with young people. We should not deceive them. We should be honest about the history of our country. And we should be not only taking down the traditional heroes like Andrew Jackson, Theodore Roosevelt, but we should be giving young people an alternate set of heroes. Instead of Theodore Roosevelt, tell them about Mark Twain. Mark Twain, well, Mark Twain everybody learns about as the author of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. But when we go to school, we don't learn about Mark Twain as the vice president of the Anti-Imperialist League. We aren't told that Mark Twain denounced Theodore Roosevelt for approving this massacre of the Philippines. No, we want to give young people ideal figures like Helen Keller. And I remember learning about Helen Keller. Everybody learns about Helen Keller. You know, a disabled person who overcame her handicaps and became famous. But people don't learn in school, and young people don't learn in school what we want them to learn when we do books like A Young People's History of the United States, that Helen Keller was a socialist. She was a labor organizer. She refused to cross a picket line that was picketing a theater showing a play about her. So there are these alternate heroes in American history. There's Fannie Lou Hamer and Bob Moses. They're the heroes of the civil rights movement. There are a lot of people who are obscure, who are not known. We have in this young people's history, we have a young hero who was sitting on the bus and in Montgomery, Alabama, refused to leave the front of the bus. And it was before Rosa Parks. I mean, Rosa Parks is justifiably famous for refusing to leave her seat, and she got arrested, and that was the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott and really the beginning of a great movement in the South. But this 15-year-old girl did it first. And so we are trying to bring a lot of these obscure people back into the forefront of our attention and inspire young people to say, this is the way to live.
That's Howard Zinn, appearing on Democracy Now! In 2009. Howard Zinn was attacked by President Trump on Thursday.
Now on to the documentary.
Most people don't confront the challenge to go to jail, but they often confront a challenge to do the right thing or to say the truth at the risk of their jobs. And they usually don't choose, I would say, to risk their careers very much, partly because they don't have examples of that. They don't. The courage of that sort is contagious, and they may or may not have the luck to meet somebody who is exhibiting that kind of courage.
When I started to write my book, my heroes were not going to be military heroes. My heroes were going to be people who fought against war, spoke out, protested against war.
Thus, in that inevitable taking of sides which comes from the selection of history, I prefer to tell the story of the discovery of America from the viewpoint of the Arawaks, of the Constitution of America from the viewpoint of the slaves, of Andrew Jackson as seen by the Cherokees, of the rise of industrialism as seen by the young women in the Lowell textile mills, of the Spanish-American War as seen by the Cubans, the conquest of the Philippines as seen by the black soldiers on Luzon, the First World War is seen from the eyes of socialists, the New Deal as seen by blacks in Harlem, and so on, to the limited extent that any one person, however he or she strains, can see history from the standpoint of others.
Plus, I thought it was intriguing that a Caucasian would tell all kinds of history of all people, like black history and Chinese people and immigrants, and that's something our school books lack.
My name's Luke. We drove up from Atlanta to see Howard Zinn. We just drove up yesterday. It's about a 12-hour drive.
He said everything that was in my head, basically. Like everything I believed, he was agreeing with, and he was expanding on it, too.
I want to teach the truth to my students someday, so that's why I'm here.
2003. Zinn speaks to a small audience in Paris. He has received an award from the French National Assembly.
I wanted, in writing this book, to awaken a consciousness in my readers of class conflict, of racial injustice, of sexual inequality, and of national arrogance. And I also wanted to bring into light the hidden resistance of the people against the power of the establishment. I thought that to omit these acts of resistance, to omit these victories, however limited by the people of the United States, was to create the idea that power rests only with those who have the guns, who possess the wealth. I wanted to point out that people who seem to have no power, working people, people of color, women, once they organize and protest and create national movements, they have a power that no government can suppress. I don't want to invent victories for people's movements, but to think that history writing must simply recapitulate the failures that dominate the past is to make historians collaborators in an endless cycle of defeat. And if history is to be creative, if it's to anticipate a possible future without denying the past, it should, I think, emphasize new possibilities by disclosing those hidden episodes of the past when, even if in brief flashes, people showed their ability to resist, to join together, occasionally to win. I'm supposing, or perhaps only hoping, that our future may be found in the past's fugitive moments of compassion rather than in the solid centuries of warfare.
I think that I wrote a people's history because I was looking for such a history and it didn't exist. I was not at all sure I would go through it. It is a very daunting task, and several times I started to give up on it, and my wife Farah said, no, you must do this. You must keep at it. And probably without her insistence, I might have dropped the idea, because, you know, the idea of writing a book which takes in all of American history and try to put it into one volume, it was a big, big job. Roz is actually my first editor. She's the only person I show my work to before it goes to the publisher, because she's a reader. She's not particularly a reader of history. She's a reader of novels, and she knows what good writing is, and also she can look at history from the standpoint of somebody who is not a professional historian, and who can say, you know, this doesn't make any sense, or this isn't clear, or you're going too far.
Anyone reading history should understand from the start that there is no such thing as impartial history. The chief problem in historical honesty is not outright lying. It is omission or de-emphasis of important data. The definition of important, of course, depends on one's values. We are not starting from scratch. There is a long history in this country of rebellion against the establishment, of resistance to orthodoxy. There has always been a common sense perception that there are things seriously wrong and that we can't really depend on those in charge to set them right.
I always was interested in theater, but too busy with teaching and writing about history and movements and so on to venture into the theater until when the war in Vietnam ended in 1975, I felt I had a moment to breathe. I no longer had to run around the country making speeches about the war. And so I sat down and wrote a play about Emma Goldman, who had become one of my heroes, an anarchist, feminist, outrageous woman. And then more recently, I did Marx in Soho, a one-person play about in which Karl Marx returns to the present.
Well, when I wrote my play, Emma, and for the first time I was in the theater, and suddenly I found I wasn't alone. It's a very intense experience, you know, rehearsing every day, every night, being with the same people over and over again. And it's very, very different than writing a book, you know, writing anything where you're on your own.
Right.
Yeah, you're an isolated individual.
Actor Brian Jones playing Karl Marx in Zinn's play, Marx in Soho.
Giant merger between Chase Manhattan Bank and Chemical Bank. 10,000 workers to lose jobs. Stocks rise. And they say my ideas are dead.
You know, from 1960, the Civil Rights Movement, to 1999, the WTO, Howard has managed to make himself useful, you know, of service to one generation of rebels after another. And that's very, very difficult to have that kind of perseverance.
Remember, to be radical is simply to grasp the root of a problem. And the root is us. I have a suggestion. Pretend you have boils. Pretend sitting on your gives you enormous pain. So you must get up. You must move. You must act. Let's not talk anymore of capitalism, socialism. Let's just talk of using the incredible wealth of the earth for human beings. Give people what they need. Food, water, clean air, pleasant homes to live in, trees, some grass. Some hours of work. More hours of leisure. Don't ask who deserves it. Every human being deserves it.
When he tells people about the truth of American history, and not the myth, and he really is clear, the young people have an enormous sense of relief.
Do you think there'll be students tonight who are not anti-war, who have just come out of curiosity?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely.
Those are the ones we want.
War doesn't solve fundamental things. It's like crack. Really. War, you know, war is like a fix. You know, you get high on war. We won. And then you're down on the ground again. And you need another fix. You need another war. Why do you think we've had war after war after war after war? Every war, during every war, they say, this is the end. This is the last war. In World War I, they said, this is the war to end all wars. And then, not long after that, was World War II. And then soon, the United States was waging war in Korea, and then in Vietnam. Then in Grenada. Imagine making war on Grenada, you know? What a great victory that was for the United States to defeat Grenada. If you study history, what you learn is that wars are always accompanied by lies. Wars are always accompanied by deceptions. Wars are always accompanied by, oh, we're going to war to fight for democracy, we're going to war to fight for freedom. Behind all the lies and deceptions that accompanied all these wars, you know, was one basic motive that is behind all of these wars. Expansion, power, economics, business, really.
The VA, 10 years after the Gulf War, reported that 8,000 veterans of the Gulf War were dead for various reasons. That of the 600,000 soldiers who fought in the Gulf War, 200,000 of them after the Gulf War filed claims with the Veterans Administration for disabilities that they had suffered during the war as a result of the weaponry that the United States was using in the war. The weapons that we use against other people are also used against us. A government that is ruthless about what it does to other people is also ruthless in what it does, you know, to our own people.
Following the attacks of September 11, the George W. Bush administration starts beating the drums for war against Afghanistan and Iraq. Zinn joins the large-scale public opposition to starting such a war.
We're at war, they said, and I thought, they have learned nothing, absolutely nothing, from the history of the 20th century, from 100 years of retaliation, vengeance, war, 100 years of terrorism and counterterrorism, of violence met with violence, in an unending cycle of stupidity. Our security can only come by using our national wealth, not for guns, planes, bombs, but for the health and welfare of our people, for free medical care for everyone, education and housing guaranteed, decent wages, and a clean environment for all. We cannot be secure by limiting our liberties, as some of our political leaders are demanding, but only by expanding them. We should take our example not from our military and political leaders shouting retaliate and war, but from the doctors and nurses and medical students and firemen and policemen who have been saving lives in the midst of mayhem, whose first thoughts are not violence, but healing, not vengeance, but compassion.
It's exactly when you're in the midst of a war or about to go into a war that you need your freedom of speech. You need the most sharp and honest discussion of what is going on, because lives are at stake. War is a matter of life and death. That's when you need to make sure you're doing the right thing in national policy. And if at that moment, because of war, your free speech is hampered, if you are put in fear of speaking out, then democracy has been severely crippled. That's what's happening today.
An anti-war rally in Boston Commons, 2002, prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
In 1999, ABC asked Dr. Zinn what was on his mind at the close of the century. He answered in part, "What I'm thinking about is the need to have the next century not filled with war. The people of all nations in the world are getting tired, I think, of the national rhetoric driving people to war." Well, let me not speak the man's words for him. Let me give them to you, Dr. Howard Zinn.
I haven't seen a crowd like this, really, for a very long time. And it's really heartening to be here. This is democracy. Democracy is not there. Democracy is not in the White House. We can't find democracy in Congress or the Supreme Court. This is where democracy is, places like this all over the country. If you go to war against a tyrant, you are killing the victims of the tyrants. The deaths of all these people will be explained in the way that deaths of people have always been explained, with lies and deceit. We have another accident that is collateral damage. That's the language of terrorism. But people are going to be hurt. And then, will Iraq be, after all of that, will Iraq be a democracy? The real question is, will the United States be a democracy? And so if we've got a war, we may not lose many Americans. All that we'll lose will be the soul of America. Yeah. We live in a beautiful country that's been taken over by men who have faith in guns and bombs. And I think we will need to take our country back. Thank you.
I suppose what it suggests to us is that we have a big job to do, a very big job to do. These things, the good things that have been done, the reforms that have been made, the wars that have been stopped, the women's rights that have been won, the racism that has been partly extirpated in society, all of that was not done by government edict. It was not done by the three branches of government. It was not done by that structure which we learn about in junior high school, which they say is democracy. It was all done by citizens' movements. And then keep in mind that great movements in the past have arisen from small movements, from tiny clusters of people that have gotten together here and there. If you have a movement strong enough, it doesn't matter who's in the White House. What really matters is what are people doing, and what are people saying, and what are people demanding, you see.
Hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents, and to live now, as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory.
So Rumsfeld is explaining the threats to the West and why they are invisible and unidentifiable. And he says, I'm quoting him now, because I could not make this up. There are things that we know, and there are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things we now know that we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. These are things we do not know, we do not know. He goes on to say, simply because you do not have evidence that something exists doesn't mean that you have evidence that it doesn't exist.
Here ends the 2004 film documentary on Howard Zinn, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, directed by Deb Ellis and Dennis Mueller. Edited and adapted to radio by yours truly. The brief readings from Zinn's works were by Matt Damon. Thanks to democracynow.org for the additional audio. If you missed an earlier segment of this series, or any other installment of New World Notes, you can catch it on our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, reminding you that you are not alone, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. And as Chief Halftown used to say, Easta sa sasaway.